right, everybody, welcome back. We are continuing on in chapter 3 of Genesis. We're going to start off by reading verse 1 through 6, which talks about the fall of mankind. And it reads, "And the serpent was more crafty than any beast of the field, which Yahweh Elohim had made. And he said to the woman, 'Is it true that Elohim has said, do not eat of every tree of the garden?' And the woman said to the serpent, 'We are to eat the fruit of the trees of the garden, but of the tree of the, but of the fruit of the tree which is in the midst of the garden, Elohim has said, do not eat, nor touch it, lest you die.' And the serpent said to the woman, 'You shall certainly not die, for Elohim knows that in the day that you eat of it, your eyes shall be opened, and you shall be like Elohim, knowing good from evil.' And the woman saw that the tree was good for food, and that it was pleasant to the eyes, and a tree desirable to make one wise. So she took its fruit and ate, and she gave also to her husband with her, and he ate." All right, so let's dig into this and see, how does this apply to marriage? What is going on here? And remember, we are only talking about this from the marriage aspect. There's a lot more that you could glean from it as a lawsuit against the father himself. But what is this? How does this play into the marriage aspect of it? Because I want to propose to you that this whole thing is about a failed marriage. And let's look at it. Why was the serpent in the Garden of Eden? Why was he in the midst of the garden to begin with? What was Adam's role supposed to be? Adam was charged with working and guarding, was he not? And what was he supposed to guard? Right? That term sometimes is misunderstood, but if you look at the last verse in chapter 3 here, it talks about where Yahweh places the cherubim to the east of the Garden of Eden with a flaming sword which turned every way to guard the way to the tree of life. It's a military, a guarding, like a sentry type role to prevent things from getting in. And so since there was nothing else in the world at that time that should have been able to harm people, we can basically surmise that Adam's role was to guard the garden against this serpent that had gotten in. And also, in the same manner, he was supposed to guard his wife against this serpent as well. So we see here right off the bat that Adam has failed in his divine mandate. He's failed in his job, his duty as a husband to guard his wife. And the next question we come to then, why does the serpent speak to Isha, to the wife of Adam? Shouldn't the proper structure of authority be that this serpent be speaking to Adam since he's supposed to be the head of the household? Well, we see that that is not what is going on here. And why is that? Well, what we have to do is look into what the Hebrew is actually saying here. When you look at the word that's translated generally as serpent, you'll see that it's the Hebrew word nachash. And while nachash can mean serpent, and I believe one of the reasons why they believe it means serpent is because it's the same gematria as the other word in Hebrew for serpent. But there's other meanings of nachash. Nachash can be used for brass, for enchantment, for shining. And so what does that all mean? Why is that important? It has to do with the nature of men and women. Think about this. Think about, say, you know, you're watching a movie about people who go out to a bar, right? When you're in a bar, what happens there generally? What are most of the men in that bar attracted to? Most of the men in that bar are going to be attracted to the most scantily clad woman who is also the most attractive. Us men, we are attracted to things that catch our eye. We're attracted to physical beauty or shininess, right? Women, on the other hand, are not so much. I mean, now, I'm not saying that women don't enjoy, you know, things that look beautiful, especially in a guy. But if you're in this bar scenario, what guy is the lady most likely to go home with if that's what she's there? If she's just looking for a guy, who is she most likely to go home with? The guy that looks the best, who's the, you know, has the biggest muscles and everything, Or is it going to be the guy who can talk the smoothest to her? And that's what we're dealing with here, is because those women will go home with the smooth talker. Women are enticed through their ears, you know. So the serpent, knowing this, he comes up and he is a nechash. He's something shiny, kind of like a television almost. That's how, what I always think of when I read this now, is the guy is just sitting there like, wow, shiny object. And the woman, on the other hand, she's not, you know, she's not completely mesmerized by this shiny object. She's like, well, I want to hear what he has to say. And so the serpent, being the most crafty beast of the field, he knows this. And so what does he do? He comes up to Chava, or to Isha, as she's known at this point in time, and he starts talking smoothly to her. He entices her with words. And isn't that funny? Because even in the Torah, right, a man, if his wife or his daughter make a vow in his presence, he's allowed to disavow that vow on the day that he hears of it. Because Yahweh knows he's created women with that ability to be enticed through their ears. And so he's given men the ability to act as a protector for the women, because women do have this weakness, and so a man can disavow that. All right, the word crafty there is also a very interesting word. It's the Hebrew word arum, which is H6175. And as you can see here, it is very similar to a word that we talked about in Genesis 2, the word arom, which is the word used for naked. Let's go back there to Genesis 2, verse 25 really fast. And it reads, "And they were both naked, the man and his wife, yet they were not ashamed." And if I remember right, that is actually Hebrew, or the Strong's number H6174. But here, this word crafty is H6175, almost, you know, just one letter or one number off in the Hebrew numbering system. And as you can see here, I put them both up here as how they would appear in the Hebrew without the nikud, or the vowel points. You can see here on the one side, you have arum, and then on the other side, you have arom. And the only difference there is a little dot in front of that vav, or actually, you know, behind it, if you're reading the correct way from right to left. But the point here is that these two words look almost identical. There's just a little difference here. And so what I want to propose here is that the devil, the serpent, while it does, you know, kind of make him sound like he is a serpent, beneath the text, if we look at this, what we can see is actually going on here is that he is almost exactly like them. Because remember, they were arom. They were naked, but specially clothed, is what that word really means. And yet, Satan is said to be arum, almost exactly the same, but just a little different. And so I think that's kind of why they were so, you know, enticed to listen to him. Not that he was something completely different, but he was almost exactly like them, but just a little off. And how much more so is that today, you know, in our world today? It's not the people that are absolutely wicked, the devil worshipers, that we're worried about. What we're worried about is those tares in the midst of the wheat, those ones that look almost identical to us, but there's something just a little off, just enough that there turns out to be a huge problem. And as we all know, this is the fall of mankind, just because they saw someone who looked almost like him, just a little bit different. So the serpent was cunning, because the word, you know, while it does, but beneath the text, imply cunningness, beneath the surface, it means it implied that he was similar to them. It also means that he was cunning. He was crafty. And how was he? What were these smooth words that he used with Isha? He calls into question God. That's very apparent, but there's also something there hidden. He says, let me turn there to verse 3. He says, is it true that Elohim said, do not eat of every tree of the garden? Now, who did Elohim tell that to? if you turn back to Genesis 2, in Genesis 2, verse 16, it's Elohim commanding Adam not to eat of every tree. Isha was not even created at the point in time when this command was given. We have no record of this command ever being given to Isha. It was only given to Adam. And so while he was calling into question God's authority, he was also calling into question Adam's authority and Adam's ability to transmit that commandment to his wife. So he was essentially right there driving a wedge into their relationship. While Adam is mesmerized and doing what he, because Adam should have been, he should have immediately stepped up and said something to the serpent when the serpent starts talking to his wife. But he's mesmerized. And so as he is mesmerized, now Isha is being fed this line. Are you really sure that Adam really said that? Did God really say that? Is that what God really meant? You will not surely die. And so what happens here is that Isha listens to him and ends up eating the fruit. And if you look at this and you compare this to ancient Near Eastern covenant lawsuits, this is exactly what's going on here. Satan is entering into a covenant lawsuit against the creator of heaven and earth. Now, how could he do that? What would be the purpose of that? Well, if you remember back to chapter 1, we see that Adam and Isha were created in the image of Elohim. They weren't created in the image of Yahweh, of Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, but instead in the image of Elohim. And the term Elohim means judge, right? So if they're created in his image, that gives them the right to judge. And that's why in the book of Revelation, you see us being able to judge because we are created in the image of Elohim, the great judge, the great creator. And so Satan, realizing this, he now enters into this covenant lawsuit, hoping that Adam and Chava will judge their creator as guilty, and thus trying to completely flip the authority structure. Because at that point in time, the authority structure, the legal authority structure, I'm not talking about importance, because as I think I've put it out clear, men and women have equal importance, but there is a structure. And so the structure at this point in time was Yahweh, the man, the woman, and then the beasts of the field, right? And so Satan's trying to flip that around and make it now Satan, the woman, the man, and God on the bottom. And so this is what's happened, and Chava goes along with it because Adam is not fulfilling his role. And another thing that Satan is essentially telling her is that if you do this, because remember, what does it say? You shall certainly not die. For Elohim knows that in the day you eat of it, your eyes will be opened and you will be like Elohim. He's talking to the woman. He's saying, you, the woman, will be like Elohim, which basically is saying, you will be above authority of your husband. He's enticing her because your husband's not doing your job or his job. Now you can take that job. You can be the boss in the relationship. You can be the head of the household in my kingdom if you just submit to me. And that would make Adam the vassal. And so Eve is enticed by this. And we'll actually see in a little bit here how this is exactly what the so-called curse of the woman is dealing with, is this sort of thinking. All right, let's read verse 7 through 10. Then the eyes of both of them were open, and they knew that they were naked, and they sewed fig leaves together and made loin coverings for themselves. And they heard the sound of Yahweh Elohim walking about in the garden in the cool of the day. And Adam and his wife hid themselves from the presence of Yahweh Elohim. And Yahweh Elohim called unto Adam and said to him, Where are you? And he said, I heard your voice in the garden, and I was afraid because I was naked, so I hid myself. So we've already kind of talked about this. Remember in in chapter 2, verse 25, they were naked, but it's a different word there. It's Arom versus Erom. And Arom means that they were either partially naked or that they were clothed in special garments, most likely garments of light. Whereas here they are Arom, they are completely naked, and they are shamefully naked at that. So, as we well know, this was written to the Israelites coming out of Egypt. So what would they have thought when they hear that he was shame, that Adam and Isha were made shamefully naked? Well, if you've watched my series, Hem and the Garment, in the ancient Near Eastern context, the clothing was very significant. And if a man was to divorce his wife because she committed adultery, what he would do is he would take her out into public and he would strip her naked. He would take her clothes off. And this was signifying, first off, shame, but it was also significant because she would have her dowry sewn into her garments. And the dowry was there. If he were to die, she would have money to provide for herself after that. But if she commits adultery, she loses that dowry. So the man strips her off and takes her dowry. And we can actually see this in Hosea 2, verse 3. Let's turn there really fast. Hosea 2, verse 3. And it reads, let's just start in verse 1. Say to your brothers, O my people, and to your sisters, O compassion one, strive with your mother, strive, for she is not my wife, nor am I her husband. Let her put away her whorings from her face and her adulteries from between her breasts, lest I strip her naked and shall set her up as on the day she was born and make her like a wilderness and shall set her like a dry land and shall put her to death with thirst. So, right there we can see this was the custom in the ancient Near East, stripping them naked. So the person reading this, as soon as they see that Adam and Isha are stripped naked, they immediately connect that with adultery, which we know that physical adultery is akin to spiritual idolatry. And I'm not trying to imply, as some people have midrashed out, that Eve slept with the serpent. I do not believe that at all. What I'm trying to say here is that this is a picture of they committed idolatry, and so immediately God strips them naked. And so what do? The first thing that they do is that they try to cover themselves up with fig leaves. Now, I really didn't know a lot about fig leaves until I started searching into these, and fig leaves aren't just like a little maple leaf. Fig leaves were actually used in the ancient Near East as umbrellas. They're a large rubbery leaf. And so they had the ability and the knowledge to sew these together and to make a garment. So it would essentially be like a rubber outfit. And that would actually be a pretty decent outfit. I mean, you know, it may not be the best outfit, but they figured out how to make outfits. They would have eventually figured out how to improve on this process. But instead, they make these fig leaves. And what is the significance of this? Why does this put this in here? What were they trying to do with these fig leaves? They're doing what we do today a lot in modern medicine. They are dealing with the symptoms and not the cause of the problem. You see, they looked at this and they go, oh, we're naked. Let's cover this up. There's a problem here, and I need to cover up this problem, to stop this problem. Much like, you know, if we have a headache today, we would take an aspirin instead of going, why do I have a headache? Oh, maybe because I'm dehydrated. Maybe I should drink more water. And so what they were essentially doing is they were putting a Band-Aid on their relationship. And how often do people do that today in their marriages? You know, they see these external problems forming. And so they go to the marriage counselors, and the marriage counselors go, well, how are we going to deal with this? How are we going to deal with that? And a lot of times, unfortunately, people just try to deal with the symptoms, and they don't go back to the root cause of the problem. And what is the root cause of the problem here? What have I been talking about this whole time here? The root cause of this problem was not that they were naked. The root cause of the problem was that man, Adam, was not acting like an ish. He was not acting like a proper man. A proper man would have guarded against the serpent from ever coming in. A proper man would have never allowed his wife to talk to this serpent, this Nahash. He would not have become mesmerized. He would not have been desiring things for himself. He would have been a giver. And so the proper course of action for Adam would have been to step up and drive that serpent out of the garden now, which we have no record of him doing. And another interesting thing here, you know, it mentions that they're shamefully naked and they try to hide not only from God, but essentially from each other. And I find that interesting because what happens in a marriage relationship when two people are getting divorced, say they've been married for 20 years, you know, they know every detail of each other's body. But as soon as their marriage is in problems and they're starting to go through the divorce process, what happens? Now they don't want to be naked in front of each other. They're embarrassed. They try to cover themselves up. And we have that same thing going on right here. I'm telling you, this whole chapter 3 here is all about a divorce and God's remedy and fix for this to, maybe not a remarriage, but at least a renewing of the covenant vows. So the next part we come into, remember how I talked about this was the serpent's covenant lawsuit against Yahweh. The next thing that happens is that now Yahweh is going to enter into a covenant lawsuit against Adam and Isha and the serpent himself. But notice, however, that the term Yahweh Elohim is used throughout the rest of this chapter, whereas with the encounter with the serpent, we do see in verse 1 it says that the serpent was more crafty than any beast of the field which Yahweh Elohim made. But during the actual dialogue between the serpent and Isha, the term Elohim is used. There's no Yahweh in there. And why is that? Because the term Elohim has to do with judgment. See, the serpent specifically uses this term because he wants it to be portrayed that Yahweh is just about judgment. That's all he's about. He's just judgment, judgment, judgment. There's no covenant loyalty. There's no covenant mercy there. But when Yahweh himself enters into this covenant lawsuit, he uses the term Yahweh Elohim, which there is judgment, but at the same time there is mercy. And what we will see here is that every single one of these indictments against Adam and Chava actually have a curse and a blessing involved in them. So let's look at the structure here. The first thing in any ancient, this is just the generic structure for a ancient Near Eastern covenant lawsuit, and you can see up here. The first thing we have is a historical prologue. This will be, you know, this is what happened, which we see here in verse 1 through 6. And then there's the calling of witnesses that's included in this historical prologue. And that's why in verse 9, we have Yahweh Elohim calling to Adam, "Where are you? Where are you?" Right? And then the next part we get to is the interrogation. And that's in what we'll read here in a little bit in verse 11 through 13, where Yahweh interrogates the man and the woman. And then after that, there's an indictment followed by a verdict. So let's see where we're at. Let's read through verse 11 through 13 here. And he said, "Who made you know that you were naked? Have you not eaten? Or have you eaten from the tree which I commanded you not to eat?" And the man said, "The woman whom you gave me to be with, she gave me of the tree and I ate." And Yahweh Elohim said to the woman, "What is this that you have done?" And the woman said, "The serpent deceived me and I ate." So what is going on here? The first thing we see, right, most people place the blame for this whole event strictly on Isha herself. But what does God do? He first goes up and confronts the man. Now, why would he do that? Because it's ultimately the man's responsibility, right? When I was in the Navy, we had incidences where there was hazing on the ship. And while the commanding officer of the ship would he had no idea this was going on. He obviously did not promote this sort of behavior. He would have never allowed it to go on had he been there. But nevertheless, it did occur on his ship. And so who ultimately got the responsibility for it, and who got the ultimate punishment for it? The commanding officer of the ship, right? He would get removed from his command because someone under his authority did something, even though he didn't know about it. So that is a very good lesson for us as men. If we truly believe and want to be the leader of the household, the head of the household, as Scripture is very clear that men are supposed to be, that means that regardless of whether you had that that choice in it, that you supported what your wife was doing, you are ultimately responsible for her actions. And you need to take responsibility for her actions. But instead, what happens? The man says, the woman that you gave me, she made me do it. So instead of taking the responsibility himself, we see that Adam places the blame on God himself, and he places the blame on his wife and tries to shirk all responsibility. And what can we learn here from this? Just what I was talking about, that men need to take responsibility. And I will tell you, it is hard to do sometimes, but it will change your life. I used to wonder, me and my wife used to fight quite often. I mean, probably not any more than many married couples out there, but we fought quite a bit. And, it was like, as soon as you start fighting, basically no one wins, right? Even if you're right and you prove to your wife that she is wrong, you lose. And she loses, because neither one of you are going to admit you're wrong, and neither one of you are going to change when you're in a fight and fighting this way. So once I realized that fighting is futile, I started thinking, well, how do I overcome this? Because obviously I'm right. Well, maybe not all the time, but there's some of the times that maybe I am right. But how do I actually make this into something good? How do we grow from this? And how do we just stop the argument? Because this is not productive at all. This principle, taking responsibility, is what it's all about. I realized that even though my wife may have done something wrong, it's ultimately my failure as a leader that caused her to do this thing that is wrong. And so what I started doing is, after I got over my pride issue, let's be honest. In the heat of the moment, you probably aren't going to think of this, but as the fight progresses, what I do, and when I'm talking about progresses, I'm talking like a minute or two into it, not like an hour or three into it, is I take responsibility. I go, you know what? You're right. I should not have done that. I was wrong. I'm sorry. I should have done this better. I should have done that better. I should have been more clear in what I was saying. I should have done this or that. And it really does work. Now, you got to remember back to the principle of the seed, right? It's not going to work the first time you try it, because first off, your wife's not going to believe you. But if you keep on doing this, if you keep on showing her this, you keep on giving to her, eventually she's going to respond. And the funniest thing now is that when my wife and I get into an argument, a disagreement, and I take this action, it actually gets her mad, but no longer at me. Now she's mad at herself, because she is like, no, you shouldn't be taking all this this blame, this responsibility. I'm at fault too. And, it's so amazing how just by me taking that responsibility has actually now has activated this role in the woman, this nurturing role. And now she goes, whoa, wait a minute. I don't want you to have this blame and this shame put on you. I want you to feel respected. And so she's responded, and it has just been so amazing to have had this this principle in my lifetime go on. So, taking responsibility. And the other thing there is in the middle of an argument, you are often going to blame and criticize. And this is a very, very important principle. If you pick up one thing out of this entire series, this is the most important principle, and it is the hardest principle for us men to take an action on and embed within us, is that you can never blame or criticize your wife. I'm going to say that one more time. Never blame or criticize your wife. Women cannot handle it. You see, because a woman desires to be perfect in her husband's eyes. It's her honor. It's her happiness. Her security is that her husband thinks that she is just absolutely perfect. And whenever you're critical of her, it completely destroys her self-image. Now, this is a very hard principle for us men to understand, because us men, we are designed to take constructive criticism. You know, it is okay for us to have our wife go, "Oh, I think you should do this better. You should do that better." But women are not the same. Remember, he created them male and female, meaning not just physical differences, but spiritual differences as well. Women cannot handle this. And so the question immediately arises, well, if I'm not supposed to criticize my wife and she's doing something wrong, what do I do to fix it? All the other stuff I've been talking about here. Remember the principle of the mirror, right? Her actions are a reflection of your actions. And so instead of trying to take that mirror and change the way the mirror looks and shaking it around, what you need to do is change yourself. Look into yourself and see, are her actions actually stemming from something of my own? I guarantee you, 9 times out of 10, at least in my life, I've found that it really is something that's stemming from my poor leadership, my poor example that I'm setting. And so let's say you do want to say something to your wife. That is okay. How do you go about doing that? What you need to do is, first off, is never speak in the heat of the moment. Because if you criticize her the second she does that, there's going to be a lot of emotions attached to that. So you need to take a mental note or a physical note, you can write it down, and then come back 2 to 3 days later and address the issue. And when you address it, you need to address it with love, with understanding, with compassion. Again, don't blame her. Don't criticize her. Just come up to her and be like, "Look, this is something that we need to work on." And try to find a way that you have been doing it too, and be like, "This is something that we need to work on. I know, I need to improve here. This is what scripture says, or this is what this is," and have that proper approach, not the demeaning, degrading, criticizing approach, the approach of building up and lifting up. And it's very important. Address it several days after the fact so that it doesn't look like you're immediately criticizing something that she does. All right, so now we're going to move on to the indictment. Let's read verse 6. I'm not going to read. We all know the indictment against the serpent, that he has to crawl on his belly. And then the promise of the seed of the woman, which is the promise of Messiah. So right there, we see a curse and we see a blessing. And that same pattern will be followed here. So let's go on to verse 16. "To the woman, he said, 'I greatly increase your sorrow and your conception. Bring forth children in pain, and your desire is for your husband, and he does rule over you.'" So right off the bat here, we can see a blessing immediately, right? You're going to have pain in childbirth, but your desire is for your husband. What would be the natural response of a woman after giving birth, right? She just goes through this entire labor, this horrifying pain, because they didn't have any pain medicine back then, right? She goes through this horrifying process, and now the man's like, "Well, my 40 days of nidah are up. Let's go at it, woman." And she's going, "You are not coming near me anymore. We are done, right? I am not going through that experience again." And yet, God knew this would happen, and so what does he do? He puts this desire in the wife for her husband, so that even though there's a very painful experience with childbearing, she still has a desire to have more children with him and to be with him after this experience. So let's now look into what it says here. And this is, unfortunately, this is a sentence that is horribly misunderstood and horribly misused against women to show that they are supposed to be a subordinate to the man. Her desire is for his husband, and he rules over her with an iron fist. Well, the only problem with that is the Hebrew doesn't say that. Once again, if you actually look back into the language the scriptures were written in, we see a different picture being formed here. The word here for rule is actually the Hebrew word mashal, which is H4910. And we can see this this word used in different other scriptures, and we'll go there and we'll see how it's actually used. So let's first turn to 2 Samuel 23, verse 3. 2 Samuel 23, in verse 3. The Elohim of Israel said, "The rock of Israel spoke to me, one who rules over man righteously." So there, it talks about Yahweh ruling over man righteously. So is this ruling over man, is this complete subordination? You're my slave, you're my servant, go do this, go do that. No, of course not. It's talking about leadership, about righteous ruling. If you turn to Matthew 20, verse, let's go there real fast. Let's go to Matthew 20, verse 25 through 26. And let's see how Yahweh chooses to rule over his people. Matthew 20, verse 25 through 26. This is Yeshua, the express image of the Father's glory. And Yeshua called to them near and said, "You know that the rulers of the Gentiles are masters over them, and those who are great exercise authority over them. But it shall not be so among you. Whoever wishes to become great among you, let him be your servant." Right? And what did Yeshua do? Yeshua came down to be our servant, to serve us, to wash our feet. It's all about servant leadership, about leading through example. And that's what this word mashal is speaking of, is not this mastery, this domination, this Baal type leadership. It's talking about the ish, the husband type leadership, the servant leadership. Let's look at a few more verses really fast here. Let's go to Proverbs 17, verse 2. Proverbs 17, verse 2. "Let my right ruling go out from your presence. Let your eyes see what is straight." The word there, right ruling, once again, is mashal, the righteous ruling. And then last example here, Zechariah 6, verse 13. Zechariah 6, verse 13. Speaking of the servant called the branch, "It is he who is going to build up the temple of Yahweh. It is he who is going to bear the splendor, and he shall sit and rule on his throne, and shall be priest on his throne, and the council of peace shall be between them both." So right there, Yeshua, the branch, who we know to be Yeshua, is going to mashal. He's going to rule from his throne. And how do we know that Yeshua rules? Through leadership by example, which is known as servant leadership. Now, let's look at one more thing here, because obviously the question arises, well, how can we be sure? This word talks about other things, right? Well, there's actually two different words in Hebrew for ruling. In Genesis 1, verse 28 here, it reads, "And Elohim blessed them, and Elohim said to them, bear fruit and increase, and fill the earth and subdue it, and rule over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the heaven, and over all the creatures that move on the earth." Well, here's the thing. The word mashal does not appear there. The word subdue is the Hebrew word kabosh, which is probably where we get the expression, let's put a kabosh on it. And then the other word there, rule over the fish of the sea, is the word radah. Completely different word from mashal. So we see here that the man is supposed to rule over his wife in a different manner than he's supposed to rule over the birds of the air and the fish of the sea. So where can we go to have a deeper understanding? These two words for desire for her husband, or desire and rule over, those are actually a very rare occurrence of the word. They actually occur in only three places in the Hebrew Bible. And the other closest occurrence to this is actually one verse over in Genesis 4, verse 7. So let's turn there. This is Yahweh speaking to Cain when after he is upset that his offering is rejected. And he says, "If you do well, is there not acceptance? And if you do not do well, sin is crouching at your door. And its desire is for you, but you should rule over it." In my translation, it says master it, but it's the same word there as mashal, rule over it. So how can we get an understanding of how do we compare those two? Sin and a woman, you know, it seems like a hard example to understand, but we got to understand in Hebrew, words can have a positive connotation and a negative connotation. So what we see here is that this desire has to do with sin, you know, with sin and the woman in some cases resisting or usurping that authority. So sin wants to take authority over the man, and he has to rule over it. He has to master it, right? But it can also have a positive connotation of a longing for it, a desire for it. And we can actually understand both of those that are happening here in Genesis 3. Both of those ways of looking at it are being used. The woman has a desire for her husband. What that really means is that she desires her husband to be a leader. She desires a good husband, a leader, a husband that is in leadership. And he is supposed to become that mashal, that righteous leader. But if he doesn't, then she will step up and take over that position of authority. And that's exactly what happened here in Genesis 3 at the beginning with the serpent. She desired a husband that would be that leader, but he failed to do that. He was mesmerized. First off, he failed in his duties of working, and so he allowed the serpent in the garden to begin with, and then he never even speaks up. And so what does she do? She steps up, and now she usurps his authority, and she actually speaks to that serpent, and so on and so forth. And we actually see that right in the next verse, because Elohim says, "Because you've listened to the voice of your wife." That was Adam's sin. He listened to the voice of his wife. That doesn't mean you can't listen to your wife's voice. What that is saying is that instead of being the leader, he became the follower. And so basically what we see here is that when he fails to be the leader, she's going to resent him and she's going to usurp his authority. And the cure for that is that the man should be, is exactly what Yahweh is trying to say here. He does rule over you. What he should do is be the mashal, the leader, over the woman. Now, one more interesting thing here is it says her desire is for her husband. It never says his desire is for his wife. Now, what does that mean? What do I mean by that? Does that mean we shouldn't desire a wife? Yes and no. We should love our wife, you know, we should have that desire on a proper level for her, but we should never lust after our wives. And that may sound very strange, but let me explain myself here really fast. What happens when you lust after something? When you lust after something, you basically give into your desire, or you have this insatiable desire to gain that object. And so when you lust after your wife, suddenly you start acting like a woman. You want to receive. You say, "You've got what I want, baby. Give it to me now." Right? And now you're willing to forego your morals. You're willing to stop being a man in order to get that from your wife. And what does that do to the wife? It repulses her because now she sees you acting like her. You're now acting like a female. And so now you have two females in the relationship. And what do we know from nature? What happens when you have two like kinds, two positive charges? What do? They repulse, right? Only opposites attract to each other. And that's why a man and a woman are attracted to each other. That's why God prescribes marriage between a man and a woman, because they are opposites. And that's why in the Torah, that's why homosexuality is forbidden, because that's two like kinds getting together. And the same thing for incest. Incest is prohibited because the two things are too alike that they do not go together well. And what happens in nature? Let's say you take two atoms that are the same. Let's say you take two hydrogen atoms that are positively charged and you push them together, you force them together. What happens? That results in what is called as nuclear fusion. And while if you just do that with two atoms, it's not going to have that effect. If you do that with a lot of them, what happens? Boom! You have a hydrogen bomb. You have nuclear fusion, and you have a massive destructive force. And Yahweh understands that, or Yahweh created that principle and puts that into nature. So we have to realize that we as men, we have to be different from our wives. And so this has been a really revealing principle to me, because I used to have a big problem with pornography. And I had overcome it. I never really understood what happened. And when I started researching this, I discovered how I overcame that problem was that I stopped lusting after my wife. I stopped treating her like an object of my desire, and instead I started giving to her. I started loving her, which the word love means to give. And, you know, your relationship gets so much better. And it's hard. You know, we're constantly bombarded with these images essentially pornography. You go to the mall, you walk by Victoria's Secrets, you're looking at pornography up there. And so when we're constantly bombarded, we're constantly given this message that you should lust after your wife, but that is not the case. That is not what God has prescribed for us. He prescribed that women should desire their husband, that they should be willing to do whatever, you know, obviously within the scope of Torah, but their desires towards their husband, they're willing to give in and to do whatever in order to receive. Whereas men are supposed to be the givers, not the receivers. So let's go on. Verse 17 through 19. And to the man he said, because you've listened to the voice of your wife and eaten from the tree which I have commanded you, saying, do not eat of it. Cursed is the ground because of you. In toil you are to eat of it all the days of your life. And the ground shall bring forth thorns and thistles for you, and you shall eat the plants of the field. By the sweat of your face you are to eat of the bread, until you return to the ground. For out of it you are taken, for dust you are, and to dust you shall return. So interesting, man is the only one who actually gets an explanation. And that's probably pretty good, because most of us men need an explanation. We need that constructive criticism in order to show us our faults so that we can correct them. And what is Yahweh's correction for Adam? What was his major failure? He failed to work and guard the garden. He failed in his job. And so God said, you are going to have to actually do your job if you want to even survive from now on. You're not just going to get things given to you. You're going to actually have to go out and work in order to survive. And that's such so amazing that God did this, because this same principle applies today. Think about all the people out there who don't have to work for a living. The people who inherit money, the people who are on welfare and just receive money for free without working, the people out there who, you know, all these things. For example, the people that win the lottery, what do? They win the lottery, and within 5 years, they've wasted away, and they've lost all their friends because free money destroys a person. Whenever you have something for free, it destroys your self-worth, and it essentially emasculates the man. You're no longer having to provide. Now you're just receiving. And, I mean, it's clear throughout society. You look at all of these people, and they are just utterly destroyed by not having to work. And it's interesting. Some research that I was looking up showed that people who retire before the age of 60 actually have a much higher chance of dying within 5 years of retirement. And within that same population, those people who retire early, men actually have an 80% higher chance of dying than women do. Now, isn't that interesting? Because men are supposed to be the one who actually goes out there and provides for the family. Not saying that women can't work, but that's the primary responsibility of the man. And so it's interesting that men would have a higher mortality rate in these cases. You know, and it gives men a purpose in life. It gives all of us. So there's so much wisdom here from the Creator. The next part, we'll read that. And man called his wife Chava, because she became the mother of all living things. And Yahweh Elohim made coats of skin for the man and his wife, and he dressed them. So the first thing here is suddenly the marriage has changed. And why do I say that? Excellent proof here. Man called his wife Chava because she became the mother, she became the mother of all living things. They had just been pronounced judgment. They had just been told that they are going to die. And right a couple verses above this, man had put the blame solely upon his wife. And if the blame was solely upon his wife, as in his mind, shouldn't he have named his wife, you know, Metim, the mother of the dead? That would make a lot more sense because, you know, it's her fault. She was the one who now is the reason why I am now going to die. But instead, he finally steps up. And I believe there's probably a little bit more interaction here than is recorded, that where he actually took responsibility. Because here he's saying, you know, I understand. Now I'm going to compliment you, woman. I am going to call you Chava. You are the mother of life. You give me life now, instead of blaming her once more. And that is so important in our relationships with our wives. And I mean, right here, you know, this is showing us how to go from being in a broken marriage to a working relationship. You speak life into your wife and you start working. You get out there and you work. You become a giver and you become her mashal, her leader. That you take that role of leadership over her. And she will respond to that. The other thing here how I know that this is either a remarriage or at least a renewing of the vows is because what takes place? He gives her a new name. There's an animal sacrifice, right? In order for God to get those skins, an animal had to be sacrificed. And both of them are clothed by Yahweh himself. It specifically says that he clothed them. And so what's the significance of all that? All of that is part of an ancient Near Eastern covenant ceremony. They would sacrifice an animal, they would give a new name, and they would give a coat. And if you want an example of that, go look at the story of Yosef and Pharaoh. When Pharaoh makes Yosef second in command, what does he do? He gives him a new name, Zaphnath-Paneah, and he puts a robe over his shoulders, thus signifying this covenant. This entering into of sonship, this suzerainty covenant that's being formed between the two of them. Some other interesting things. This same terminology of clothing is actually the same terminology used in Leviticus 8, verse 7, where the priests are clothed. Also, according to Leviticus 7, verse 8, the skins of the animal, who do those belong to? They specifically belong to the priests. So by Yahweh giving them the skins of a sacrificial animal, he is basically showing them that they are that their function still is that of a priest. Because remember back in chapter 2 where Adam is told to guard and work the garden, those same terms are told that's the duty of the priest, is to work and to guard. And so here we see this reaffirming of the priesthood upon him. And then if you go into, and I really highly recommend it if you haven't watched it, my video, The Hem and the Garment. In the ancient Near East, if a son was disowned, they would be stripped of their outer garment, because that outer garment signified their inheritance. That's why Yosef in his coat of many colors, as it's so called, that was a special coat that signified a special inheritance. And so if they were readopted after this, the parent would go and they would take that garment and they would put it back upon their child's body, showing that they are now readopted. So what we see here is that Yahweh is readopting and reaffirming that commitment and continuity of their inheritance, that they're not going to, you know, they eventually will return to that inheritance. And that's why it was actually a leather garment, because in the ancient Near East, leather represents mastery over the world. That's why The shoe, remember, in the story of Ruth, the other redeemer whose name was Ploni Almoni, in the Hebrew, he gives his shoe to Boaz, thus signifying the transference of property. The shoes were made out of leather, and so that he was giving over that mastery over that part of the earth. All right, so finishing up here, let's read the last two verses here. Or three verses. And Yahweh Elohim said, "See, the man has become like one of us, knowing good and evil. Now, lest he put out his hand and take also from the tree of life and eat and live forever." So Yahweh Elohim sent him out of the Garden of Eden to till the ground from which he was taken. And he drove the man out. And he placed the cherubim at the east of the Garden of Eden, and a flaming sword to turn each every way to guard the way to the tree of life. So I want you to notice the two words here. He sent him out of the garden. The word there is shalach, which is a Hebrew idiom for divorce. Now I want to turn to Deuteronomy 24 to show you this example and to show you some confusion that's out there because some people think that the word shalach doesn't mean divorce. It means to improperly divorce or to put someone away without a divorce certificate. But I want you to read this here in Deuteronomy verse 20, chapter 24, verse 3. This is speaking of if a woman is divorced by her first husband because she found no favor in his eyes because of a matter of uncovered-ness, he writes her a certificate of divorce and puts it in her hand and sends her out of the house. Sent her out is shalach. And if she left his house and went and became another man's wife, and the latter husband shall hate her and write her a certificate of divorce. The word there for certificate of divorce is sefer keritut, which is only found, that word keritut is only found in combination with the word sefer, meaning a bill or a scroll of divorce. That term, sefer keritut, only speaks of a document of divorce, a certificate of divorce. It is not talking about the act of divorce itself. You can look it up. Every time that word appears, it's always in combination with certificate of divorcement. And reading on here, if the latter husband shall hate her and write her a certificate of divorce and put it in her hand and send her out of his house. Send her out, once again, is the word shalach there. The word shalach is just a generic term for divorce. And so in Genesis 3 here, the ancient reader, having seen that, would immediately recognize what is happening here is a divorce. He sent him out. And just to back that up, again in verse 24, he says, "And he drove the man out." The word for drove out is garash, which is found in Genesis 21, verse 10, where Hagar is driven out by Abraham. So that is once again signifying divorce. And then we can also find that in Leviticus 21, verse 7, and in verse 14, where it talks about a Levite is not to marry a garash isha, a divorced woman. So very clearly, using those two terms of divorce plus the stripping of the garment, it is very clear that this is all talking about a divorce. And so just to finish up here, why is Adam driven out? It never says Chava was driven out. It only says Adam. Now, obviously, Chava went with him, but why specify Adam only? Because Adam is the head of the household. He is the authority, and therefore he takes the responsibility for the problems in the marriage. So that concludes part two of the series, Marriage is a Covenant. I really hope you've enjoyed that. If you have any questions, please, you can go on the Wisdom and Torah forums, or you can email me at rootedintorah@gmail.com. I would love to answer any questions you have. So let's see, in the future, the next part of the series, we're going to be going into the ancient Near Eastern understanding of marriage and divorce. We're going to be looking at Exodus 21, Deuteronomy 24, and just the whole culture in the time of Moses on divorce and remarriage. Because let's face it, the scriptures just are not very, they don't have a lot of stuff dealing with it. There's a lot of assumed knowledge. So we're going to go in and look at what their culture was so we can see what that assumed knowledge was. So I really hope you guys have enjoyed it. And, like I said, let me know if you have any questions. And until next time, shalom.
He still speaks from heaven each and every day. I'll let Yisrael say.